It's summer of 2016 in Kansas City, Missouri.
This is my colleague Lydia Emanuelidou.
And we're on stage at an award ceremony.
And the Hugo goes to Folding Beijing.
Yay!
Folding Beijing is a novelette written first in Mandarin and then translated to English.
All human have to nowadays have to face the problems of automation.
That's the author of the story. Her name is Haojing Fang, and she's on stage holding her rocket-shaped award and delivering her acceptance speech.
In my story, I give one of the solutions, a quite dark one.
It's a dystopian tale that Haojing Fang tells. So she envisions a future Beijing that's come up with some really dark ways to deal with overpopulation, pollution, and many other problems, including separating people into sections by socioeconomic class and putting people to sleep through soporific gas so they can take turns living out their lives.
I don't know what will happen in the true future, but I do hope that the real future will be brighter than my story.
And that story made Haojing Fang the first Chinese woman to win the Hugo. And by the way, Patrick, you may notice that I'm introducing some people by their surname first. That's because that's how they wanted to be identified.
I'm watching the video of this thing, of this award ceremony. There's a guy standing off to the side, and he's also holding one of the awards. Who is he?
His name is Ken Liu, so he's an absolutely key figure. He translated this story and many, many others, including the book that won the Big Hugo Award for Best Novel the year before, in 2015. It's called The Three-Body Problem by Liu Cixin. And that book, it's part of a trilogy, made a big splash here in the U.S. You had people like Barack Obama and Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg praising it. And that Hugo win was also a really big deal because that was the first time a book that wasn't originally written in English won the award.
Think about that for a minute. Does a book that imagines the future that's not written in English, is it imagining a future that's specific to the language it is written in, specific to the people who speak that language? I'm Patrick Cox, and on The World in Words today, the sci-fi of another language, how a Chinese imagining of the future has gone global.
I wondered, when did Chinese sci-fi begin? For an answer, I visit Mingwei Song. He teaches Chinese literature at Wellesley College here in Massachusetts. He traces the origins of modern Chinese sci-fi to the beginning of the 20th century, as China's last dynasty, the Qing Dynasty, was falling.
It was like the darkest moment in Chinese history. The last decade of the Imperial China, before revolution, was about to break out.
That looming revolution in 1911 came down to what many saw as a failure by the Qing Dynasty. A failure to modernize China and to guard against foreign powers.
And the people, writers, reformers, begin to envision all kinds of futures. Where you can either have a better political system or very, very advanced technological progress. That's what we call the origin of Chinese science fiction.
In those early days, sci-fi was mostly a utopian vision of what China could become if it went through the social and technological modernization that writers and reformists felt it so desperately needed. They envisioned a future China that could be a world power, a highly educated country that the world is paying close attention to, a leader in everything from new weapons to new medicines, and a nation with a multi-party system. The fortunes of sci-fi really ebbed and flowed during the 20th century. At times, Chinese governments embraced its idealism and utopianism and packaged it into propaganda. At other times, it was suppressed because its foreign influence was supposedly polluting Chinese culture. Now, of course, Patrick, I'm fast-forwarding through a lot of history here, but by the early 2000s, homegrown science fiction really wasn't a big part of the culture. There certainly were writers who were writing sci-fi, but they were mostly sharing their work online. There was really only one sci-fi magazine at the time. It still exists today, by the way. But that was about to change. In 2006, Mingwei Song, the Wellesley professor, gets a manuscript from a friend. It's The Three-Body Problem by Liu Cixin.
Oh, right. The book you mentioned earlier, the book that changed everything.
That's right, yeah.
No spoilers, Lydia, but tell us what the book's about.
It's the story of humanity's potentially dooming encounter with this technologically and otherwise advanced alien civilization. So Professor Mingwei Song dives into The Three-Body Problem. He starts reading it, and he's just blown away.
I was at that time already totally convinced that Chinese science fiction was as good as science fiction in any country.
And over the next few years, Liu Cixin's trilogy becomes huge.
When the first volume was published in China, there were fans who loved it, but the sale was not that good. When the second volume was published, it began to gain more readers. And when the third volume was published, by that time, it's like a national sensation.
Mingwei Song is really excited, not just by this, but by a whole lot of other Chinese sci-fi he sees coming out of China around the same time. So he starts promoting Chinese sci-fi at academic conferences. He's inviting Chinese sci-fi authors to events where they'll get exposure. He even gets involved with translation projects to bring Chinese sci-fi to the U.S., but he knows that the attention the genre was getting from him and a handful of other academics in the early 2000s was not enough to elevate its profile to an international phenomenon.
You need Obama. You need Mark Zuckerberg. And you need Ken Liu.
Ken Liu. That's the guy you mentioned at the top of the podcast, right? The translator.
Yeah, that's right. And almost everyone I spoke with, Patrick, agreed that Ken Liu is the key to changing the profile of Chinese sci-fi, both in China and internationally. I met Ken Liu at the Sci-Fi Literature Conference, ReaderCon. He was one of the guests of honor, and he agreed to give me a few minutes between his last panel and his dinner. Ken and I sat across from each other at the dining table in his Marriott suite, just a few floors up from all the ReaderCon action. And I have to say, Patrick, I was a little nervous to meet Ken because he has this reputation for being intimidatingly smart and productive. But people also say he's very kind and approachable. I mean, just to give you a taste, here's the booklet that all ReaderCon attendees got. And here are just some headlines. You know, there are a few articles written about Ken Liu, if you want to read some of them.
Oh, right, yeah. Here's first one says, where does Ken Liu find the time?
Yep. This is an article focused entirely on where Ken Liu finds the time to do all of the many things that he does, yes.
Then there's another one that says, phenomenally good at not being nice.
Yep.
And this is referring to Ken Liu.
That's right.
Wow.
So that just gives you a taste of what this community thinks about Ken Liu. So when I sat down with him, I asked him this question that he says he gets asked very frequently. And that question is, what is Chinese sci-fi? How is it different from American sci-fi?
Yeah, I got to say, I would ask that question myself.
Yeah, and I hate to disappoint you, Patrick, but he says there isn't really a straight answer to that question. It's really complicated.
The basic conflict, if there's anything unique about China, it's this. China has undergone modernization in the last 3 decades that took the West something like 300 years to go through.
There's a lot of concern, Ken told me, about the idea of things spinning out of control, that the pace of change in China is just accelerating too fast, and that the economic and social gaps there are just getting wider and wider. And those are all themes that you'll find in Chinese sci-fi today.
I think most of my fellow Anglophone readers didn't really know there was a large body of interesting sci-fi being written in China, and that we're exploring very similar topics as the rest of us, but from a different perspective, from a different approach.
Ken doesn't actually have any formal training in translation, though he does have a law degree from Harvard. He has a background in computer programming, and he is a critically acclaimed novelist. He got into translation work by accident. It all started around 2011 after he read some stories by a friend of his named Chen Shufan. He was writing sci-fi as well, and Ken encouraged him to have his stories translated so he could get them published outside of China.
And though they were, you know, good technical translations, they didn't quite capture his voice. They didn't feel like good stories, and then something about his acerbic wit and his voice just wasn't coming across. So I said, you know, do you care if I try to take a stab at fixing it? I mean, I knew nothing about translation at the time.
That first translation landed both of them a small award in 2012.
And so I was like, oh, this is kind of cool. You know, if I can bring more of my friend's work into English to share with fellow Anglophone fans, that's really cool.
So Ken starts doing translation work on the side for his friends and for writers he meets along the way.
My approach was, did I like this particular story? Was it interesting to me? And if so, was it memorable? And would I enjoy actually working on and trying to recreate the author's voice?
And would it click with an American audience?
I mean, there were some stories I admired a great deal, but I just didn't know how to translate in a way that would work. One example would be, you know, Stanley Chen wrote the story.
Patrick, there he's talking about Chinese writer Chen Shufan, who I just told you about. Here in the U.S., he goes by Stanley.
You know, Stanley wrote the story in classical Chinese, essentially, a sci-fi story. It would be sort of like somebody trying to, a modern-day author, writing a sci-fi story in the language of Chaucer, let's say. I certainly am not capable of writing a sci-fi story in the language of Chaucer, so I don't see how I can convey this sense for an audience, so I couldn't do that one. Sometimes there are stories that are just very reliant on pop cultural references or historical references from China that would be very hard to convey to an American audience. So in some cases, I sort of had to give up on those.
Piece by piece, Ken Liu translated many Chinese stories, mostly short fiction. There's a story about a future where humans have been able to change their perception of time to increase productivity, a story about what cultures and beings on other planets might look like, a story about a city that's a machine. There are stories about physics, about love, about pain, all sorts of stories. And it was because of that body of work that Ken Liu was eventually approached to translate The Three-Body Problem.
That really is amazing that they would get a guy who's not trained as a translator taking on this book that is starting to make some seriously big waves.
Yeah, and I think what makes Ken particularly good at translating is that he's Chinese and he's American, and he straddles both cultures. And also, he's a lawyer. So he was able to walk writers through the submissions process to help them get legal rights to their work. It was almost like he was their agent, right? And all of that makes a huge difference for writers. Let me give you an example. There's this one writer, Tang Fei. She got a Ken Liu translation back in 2013. Her story, Call Girl, was then published in Apex magazine. And it was only after that that she started getting published in China.
Wait a minute. She doesn't get published in her own native language until her story is translated and published in English. I think I understand the power of Ken Liu now.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
I actually called up Tang Fei recently to talk to her about this. I don't speak Chinese, and she doesn't really feel comfortable speaking English, so her friend translated for us.
Based on this publishing experience, she thinks that it's kind of important to have your stories translated and introduced to people from other countries because it represents a kind of international acknowledgement.
So, Patrick, this is obviously troubling for some people, the fact that it takes having your work published in the U.S. or winning a big award here to somehow become more relevant in China. I mean, it's eventually what happened with Three Body Problem. You know, it was big in China, but it didn't get really, really big until it won the Hugo. And I asked Tang Fei if she thought this was a problem for Chinese sci-fi.
Okay.
She said no.
She think that this is kind of like giving the story a second life because it means you can rethink what is embedded in the story.
That's really interesting that you can rethink what is embedded in this story. What is she talking about there? Is she talking about like how the story gets translated or how the audience is reading it?
I think she's talking about both, because of course when you get a translation, your story is exposed to a whole new audience. But the translation process itself also changes the story. Let me introduce you to another person here, because at this point, it's not just Ken Liu doing translations of Chinese sci-fi. Crystal Huff is an editor for the Beijing-based organization Future Affairs Administration, and they work on editing translations between Chinese and English. So Crystal told me about a situation they were in recently where they had to go back to the Chinese author and point something out to him. This is what Crystal said to the author.
There are no women in this story. Can we change the genders of, you know, there are only men and only cisgender men and only heterosexual cisgender men, as far as I can tell, in this story. Can we talk about this? Like, I know that in some cultures, like, it's not necessarily noticeable if a story is entirely all straight cisgender men. But it is noticeable in my culture, particularly right now. And it is noticeable for me as someone who is not a straight cisgender man.
Wow, that's quite something to say to a writer, to get the writer to make such a fundamental change, like changing the gender of the characters.
It is a big change. And in this case, the author was okay with Crystal making that change in the story.
And it's a difficult one because there are a lot of cultural things there, and trying to take those nuances in and respect them and also make sure that the story that is the result of the translation process is something that people from my culture would be excited about is something that is a hard line to walk.
Do you ever wonder if there's some sort of cultural value lost in trying to bring up these things, make these changes?
Oh, absolutely. I worry that I am Americanizing things or that I am crystallizing things. I worry that I am inserting myself into a situation where I shouldn't be.
And that's something Crystal has heard from writers because they've been in the situation several times where they've asked the writer to make a change to make the story work for an American audience, and the writer has said no. You know, making changes like that, changing the gender of characters, obviously changes the story a lot. And I think that translation process and the reworking process is part of the reason why Chinese sci-fi has done well here.
Okay, so now the Chinese writers have won these awards and there's all of this international fame. Where are we at? What's the scene like back in China for sci-fi?
It's definitely a much bigger part of the mainstream today. There's a ton of commercial interest in the genre as well. I spoke about this with Regina Kanyu Wang. She's with a company called Storycom, which is based in Beijing and works to find and commercialize Chinese sci-fi.
Our life is science fiction now because more and more of the technology have been achieved and they come to real life. So it's easier for people to relate to this kind of change. So we think science fiction will be the future popular genre in not only literature, but also movies, games, and other media platforms.
Regina told me there are a lot more publications, magazine, publishing houses geared towards sci-fi now. You're more likely to find big sci-fi events in China. China put in a bid to host a future Worldcon. That's the largest sci-fi conference. But Regina also told me there's definitely a bubble here. And as for the future of Chinese sci-fi, who knows? And Patrick, there's one other thing. And that's sci-fi's relationship with the Chinese government.
Right. I mean, in the past, it seemed like the government couldn't really make up its mind. Like, did they want to co-opt sci-fi as a way of talking in a utopian way about the future? Or do they want to suppress it because it could be a codified critique?
To answer this question, I think it's important to think about where China is today and where it sees itself in the future. You know, obviously there are a lot of eyes on China today as this rising global power. Its economy is only second to that of the US and it's catching up. Chinese President Xi Jinping has this ambitious plan to make China a global power by 2050. He wants his country to be a leader in next generation technologies like artificial intelligence. And one thing I heard from Americans who have been exposed to the Chinese sci-fi community is how present Chinese government officials are at all things sci-fi in China, including at events that are hosted there. There really seems to be a belief that the genre can be tapped into to make that vision for a new future China come true. At the same time, there's an interesting tension here because a lot of Chinese sci-fi seems to be a warning about where China is heading, what it means for China to be developing so quickly. Like, what is the cost that comes with that sort of progress?
How did the Chinese sci-fi writers get around the censorship rules in China? There's got to be writers who test them out because they are, after all, worried about the idea of where the country might be headed.
Writers know that there are some things you just can't say, right? Like the Wellesley professor Mingwei Song told me that predicting the future of Hong Kong, for example, it won't pass. You can't do that. But not everything is so black and white. So some things that are too risky to say explicitly, the writers might suggest implicitly. There are messages that are somewhat obscure because writers are playing this little dance with censors. And just, I mean, Patrick, just imagine having to translate that and the translator's responsibility to the reader to help them understand what the writer is saying, but also their responsibility to the writer, you know, and not making obvious the thing that the writer didn't want to make obvious in the first place. That's something that Ken Liu deals with a lot.
When they engage in these so-called hidden messages, they're easily decodable by a Chinese reader, and they're intended to be easily decodable by a Chinese reader. So for me, the challenge is in those cases, how do I make the coded message explicit enough for an Anglophone reader to be able to decode it without being embedded in the context?
Could you give me a couple examples of what those messages might be?
I can't, unfortunately. Yeah. The reason is, you know, in China, what they say is, you know what I'm talking about, I know what I'm talking about, but actually making it explicit and talking about it is what will get us in trouble. And that's basically what some of these are about.
So Patrick, the literary community is very protective of itself. And that's why Ken couldn't give me any specific examples of the types of hidden messages that he struggles to translate. And that self-protection is especially necessary now that Chinese sci-fi is receiving attention internationally. Because, you know, for a long time, before Chinese sci-fi was getting the attention that it's getting today, I think it was easier for writers to get away with the sort of commentary that might get them in trouble today. It is true that a lot of Chinese sci-fi isn't about China. You know, just like we don't expect an American sci-fi author to write exclusively about America, the same is true for China. And that's the point that Ken Liu wanted me to walk away with from our conversation.
I think the big danger is to say, when we read a Chinese science fiction story and it's about censorship, we say, oh, it's just about China's censorship. It's about how China is a very dystopic place. Or we read a story about authoritarianism, we say, oh, this is very much about China's political system. But I would say that the warning is that's very dangerous to think that it's only limited to China. The kind of conflicts and forces and darkness that Chinese writers are writing about are in fact dangers everywhere. And it's much more interesting and fruitful to not view these as somehow uniquely Chinese, but rather as warnings to all of us.
Okay, I get that point. There's no way that any literature that wants to have itself considered seriously should just be reduced to allegorical interpretation. The idea is that they kind of speak to everybody beyond borders, and that's the point of literature. But I gotta say that it would be foolish simply not to consider the context. I mean, how can we walk away from the fact that these writers are Chinese, they have lived at a certain time in a certain place, and that's got to be reflected in one way or another in what they've written?
I think they would all say that their upbringing and the fact that they're living in China today very much influences their writing and their work. But I think Ken Liu's point that particularly science fiction is not just about one culture, one race, but rather humanity at large, I understand your skepticism, but I think that's a point that can be applied not just to Chinese science fiction, but American science fiction and German science fiction and all kinds of science fiction.
Lydia Emanuelidou. She's a producer here in Boston in the newsroom of the World Radio Show. And thanks to Lydia, I'm dipping into a bunch of Chinese sci-fi. You should too. Or at least see this movie. The Wandering Earth, it's called. It's been on limited release here in the US, soon to be on Netflix. Back in China, it's been breaking box office records. The Wandering Earth is an adaptation of yet another novel by Liu Cixin. And the good guys trying to save the world from annihilation? Yep, they speak Chinese. Houston, we have a competitor. That's it for this episode. Thanks this time to Neil Clark, publisher of the sci-fi mag Clark's World, also to sci-fi writer Xia Jia, and to Nina Porzuki, Tina Toby, and Mike Wilkins. Hit me up with your comments. I'm on Twitter at Patrick Cox. That's PatriCox. And I know it's been a while since the last episode. Thanks so much for your patience. And thanks for listening.